experiment episodes. You can see how really primitive the TV was, but it's interesting to kind of watch how what they were trying to say, how they were trying to do it. And then there's the three Hammer movies, Quatermass Experiment, Quatermass 2, and then Quatermass in the Pit. Yeah, in there, there's a movie called X the Unknown, also by Hammer, but Kim Newman talks about that in this movie.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that he really succeeds in convincing you that this movie is well worth paying attention to. If for no other reason, I mean, it's a finely crafted movie directed by Roy Ward Baker, a British director who spent some time in America, some really terrific movies, including Inferno, a great Robert Ryan film, Soleil.
This is a movie that knows what it's about and knows what to do.
Yeah. Newman is really good at showing, alluding us to interesting choices that Baker makes while shooting the movie to bring clarity to what's happening and to make it seem more realistic. So he does a great job, Kim Newman does, of endorsing this film, of making us see it in a new light.
So that's our British Film Institute film book, Quatermass and the Pit by Kim Newman.
Well, thanks for listening to KBOO Community Radio Portland. Film at 11 will be back next week with films from the past, the present, and the future. So until then, please keep watching the screens.
Do you miss going to the theater? Looking for some drama? Then tune in for The Strange Case of Nick M., an all-new radio play by Imago Theater on Monday, May 3rd at 10 p.m. Listeners will be taken on Imago's trippy audio journey into a fragmentary world, narrated by a cocky podcaster who has unearthed a box of long-forgotten reel-to-reel tapes. So tune in on Monday, May 3rd at 10 p.m. and get ready for a very special premiere of Imago's The Strange Case of Nick M. right here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to Arab Voices on Houston's community station, listener-sponsored commercial-free KPFT 90.1 FM, with live streaming and online archive of previous shows at both kpft.org and arabvoices.net. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. This show is syndicated and it airs on other radio stations in different states in the U.S. Last week on Arab Voices, I aired part one of the remarks delivered at the Arab Uprisings Revisited event held earlier this year at the Baker Institute for Public Policy in Houston, Texas. It was a two-part series event sponsored by the Baker Institute Center for the Middle East. Experts examined the legacy of the Arab Uprisings that started 10 years ago and their impact across the region today. Part 1 discussion that I aired last week focused on youth, protests, and governance. And Part 2, which I plan on airing today on Arab Voices, explores geopolitics and the region's shifting alliances. But first, and on the occasion of Ramadan, I'd like to extend my best wishes to the Muslim community for a blessed Ramadan. Ramadan started on Tuesday, April 13th. It is the 9th month of the lunar calendar that Islam follows, which means that the months of the year are measured according to the revolutions of the moon around the earth. Each month begins with the sighting of the new moon. And because the lunar calendar is approximately 11 days shorter than the solar calendar, Islamic holidays, including Ramadan, move about 11 days each year. During the month of Ramadan, Muslims abstain from food, drink, and other sensual pleasures from break of dawn to sunset to complete one of the five pillars of Islam and to achieve greater self-discipline, self-purification, and compassion for those less fortunate. Ramadan has a special significance since it is the month in which Muslims show empathy towards the poor and the downtrodden. Fasting serves many purposes, and self-discipline is one of the primary objectives of the fast. Fasting is also an opportunity to practice self-control and to cleanse the body, mind, and soul. It helps Muslims feel the peace that comes from spiritual devotion as well as kinship with fellow believers. Ramadan is the most blessed month of the year. It is a time for reflection, prayer, and renewal of faith. The end of Ramadan will be marked by communal prayers called Eid al-Fitr, or Feast of the Fast Breaking, and that will be on or about May 13th. According to some estimates, Islam is the fastest growing religion in the world, with over 1.8 billion Muslims worldwide. Muslims are also a growing segment of the American society, with over 7 million Muslims in the U.S. President Joe Biden issued a statement on Ramadan in which he said, quote, "Jill and I send our warmest greetings and best wishes to Muslim communities in the United States and around the world. Ramadan Kareem." President Biden also said, quote, "Muslim Americans have enriched our country since our founding. They are as diverse and vibrant as the America they have helped build. Today, Muslims are leading in our efforts to fight COVID-19, playing a pioneering role in vaccine development and serving as frontline healthcare workers. They are creating jobs as entrepreneurs and business owners, risking their lives as first responders, teaching in our schools, serving as dedicated public servants across the nation, and playing a leading role in our ongoing struggle for racial equity and social justice." President Biden continues, "But still, Muslim Americans continue to be targeted by bullying, bigotry, and hate crimes. This prejudice and these attacks are wrong. They are unacceptable, and they must stop. No one in America should ever live in fear of expressing his or her faith, and my administration will work tirelessly to protect the rights and safety of all people. On my first day as president, I was proud to end the shameful Muslim travel ban, and I will continue to stand up for human rights everywhere. As we remember those who have lost since last Ramadan, we are hopeful for brighter days ahead. The Holy Quran reminds us that God is the light of the heavens and earth, who leads us out of darkness to the light." That was a statement from President Joe Biden. Arab Voices would like to wish the Muslim community a happy and blessed Ramadan. Ramadan Mubarak wa kull aam wa antum bikhair. This month, April, is National Arab American Heritage Month, a celebration and recognition of Arab Americans, their rich culture, heritage, and their contributions. Arab Americans have always been, and for hundreds of years, a vital part of the American society. According to the Arab American Institute, Arab immigrants began coming to the United States in sizable numbers during the 1880s. Today, it is estimated that nearly 3.7 million Americans trace their roots to an Arab country. Arab Americans are found in every state, but more than two-thirds of them live in just 10 states: California, Michigan, New York, Florida, Texas, New Jersey, Illinois, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Virginia. Metropolitan Los Angeles, Detroit, and New York are home to one-third of the population. The majority of Arab Americans are native-born, and nearly 82% of Arabs in the United States are citizens. While the community traces its roots to every Arab country, the majority of Arab Americans have ancestral ties to Lebanon, Syria, Palestine, Egypt, and Iraq. Arabs are ethnically, religiously, and politically diverse, but descend from a common linguistic and cultural heritage. For example, not all Arabs are Muslims, and not all Muslims are Arabs. For over a century, Arab Americans have made countless contributions to every aspect of the American society. In education, literature, law, art, science, astronomy, medicine, business, economy, technology, government, culture, film, poetry, storytelling, philosophy, politics, cooking, architecture, arts and crafts, language and calligraphy, music, and a whole lot more. The contributions of Arab Americans has helped build a better nation. Many officials and governmental agencies, local, state, and national, as well as several school districts, issued National Arab American Heritage Month proclamations. The United States State Department recognized April as National Arab American Heritage Month. Here is Ned Price, State Department spokesman.
Today, the Department of State is proud to recognize April as National Arab American Heritage Month. The United States is home to more than 3.5 million Arab Americans, representing a diverse array of cultures and traditions. Like their fellow citizens, Americans of Arab heritage are very much a part of the fabric of this nation, and Arab Americans have contributed in every field and profession. Many of them, in fact, serve here at the State Department and throughout the interagency, and their careers are as diverse as their backgrounds. We mark National Arab American Heritage Month, noting these contributions that are as old as America itself.
Several local and national Arab American organizations are holding events during National Arab American Heritage Month to celebrate the rich culture, history, and heritage. In Houston, Texas, the Arab American Cultural and Community Center is organizing several events through the month of April, and you can find a list of those events on the organization's Facebook page, ACC Houston. On the national level, the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, ADC, is also holding several events, and they are listed on ADC's webpage, adc.org. The Arab American National Museum, the first and only museum in the United States devoted to documenting and sharing Arab American contributions that shaped the economic, political, and cultural landscapes of American life, that also brings to light the shared experiences of immigrants and ethnic groups, paying tribute to the diversity of our nation, is also organizing several virtual events in April, including virtual tours, in celebration of National Arab American Heritage Month. You will find the details at www.arabamericanmuseum.org. It is a great resource for enhancing the understanding of Arab American history, arts, culture, and contributions. You're listening to Arab Voices on Houston's community station, KPFT 90.1 FM. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Last week on Arab Voices, I aired part one of the remarks delivered at the Arab Uprisings Revisited event held earlier this year at the Baker Institute for Public Policy in Houston. The Arab Uprisings Revisited was a two-part series sponsored by the Baker Institute Center for the Middle East. Experts examined the legacy of the Arab uprisings that started 10 years ago and their impact across the region today. Part 1 discussion that I aired last week focused on youth, protests, and governance, and Part 2, which I plan on airing shortly on Arab Voices, explores the geopolitics and the region's shifting alliances. Part 2 discussion was moderated by Dr. Qadir Yildirim, Fellow for the Middle East at the Baker Institute, whose main research interests include politics and religion, political Islam, politics of the Middle East, and Turkish politics. The speakers were Dr. Stephen Cook, Ine Enrico Matti, Senior Fellow for the Middle East and Africa Studies and Director of International Affairs Fellowship for Tenured International Relations Scholars at the Council on Foreign Relations, Dr. Michelle Dunn, Director and Senior Fellow at the Middle East Program at Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and Dr. Peter Mandeville, Senior Research Fellow at Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace and World Affairs at Georgetown University, and Professor of Government and Politics at Char School of Policy and Government at George Mason University, and non-resident Senior Fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. Let's listen in.
Thank you for being here on our second webinar on the 10th anniversary of the Arab Spring protest. We have a great event here with three panelists. So last week, my colleague, Kelsey Norman from Baker Institute, moderated a panel with Amani Jamal, Sunil John, and Shibli Telhami. That was the first event on our series on the Arab Spring protests, on the 10th anniversary of the protests. Today, we're excited to have the second panel on the effects of these protests. At a time when the American political scene is characterized by unprecedented instability and change, it's not a bad time to turn back and look at what the Arab Spring protests have brought to the regional countries, regional dynamics, and what they might imply for American foreign policy in the Middle East and North Africa region. While there is a tendency to think about the protests as somewhat limited efforts focused on introducing democratic changes, it has increasingly become clear that the effects of this wave of protests in the Arab world was profound and transformative. What is the impact of these protests on regions' authoritarian regimes? As a result of these protests, are we seeing a wave of democratization or authoritarian entrenchment? Did these regimes change the way they handle dissent and opposition? What kinds of lessons can we draw as a result of these protests at the domestic level? Another set of questions concerns, did the wave of protests affect regional politics? Are we witnessing the emergence of new alliances in the region? Or old ones being reinforced? What are the moving dynamics of regional shifts in the region? And lastly, last but not least, how do these regional changes affect U.S. policy and engagement with the broader Middle East and North Africa region? With the incoming Biden administration in a week, what kinds of changes should we expect toward the region? How do the regional changes affect U.S. interests in the region? We have three distinguished panelists with us today in Stephen Cook, Michelle Dunn, and Peter Mandeville. Let me introduce them very briefly, and then we'll continue with the presentation. Stephen Cook is Eni Enrico Mattei Senior Fellow for the Middle East and Africa Studies and Director of International Affairs Fellowship for Tenure, International Relations Scholars at the Council of Foreign Relations. He's an expert on Arab and Turkish politics, as well as U.S. Middle East policy. Stephen Cook is the author of False Dawn, Protest, Democracy, and Violence in the New Middle East, The Struggle for Egypt, From Nasser to Tahrir Square, Ruling but Not Governing, the Military and Political Development in Egypt, Algeria, and Turkey. And his forthcoming book, The End of Ambition, America's Past, Present, and Future in the Middle East, is being published with the Oxford University Press in 2022. Michelle Dunn is the director and a senior fellow in Carnegie Endowment's Middle East program, where her research focuses on political and economic change in Arab countries, particularly Egypt, as well as US policy in the Middle East. She was the founding director of the Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council from 2011 to 2013, and was a senior associate and editor of the Arab Reform Bulletin at the Carnegie Endowment. Michelle was a Middle East specialist at the U.S. Department of State between 1986 and 2003, where her assignments included the National Security Council, the Secretary's Policy Planning Staff, the U.S. Embassy in Cairo, the U.S. Consulate General in Jerusalem, and the Bureau of Intelligence and Research. She also served as a visiting professor of Arabic language and Arab studies at Georgetown between 2003 and 2006. And Peter Mandeville, he's a professor of government and politics at the Shard School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. He's also a non-resident senior fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution and senior research fellow at Georgetown University's Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace and World Affairs. From 2015 to 2016, he was a senior advisor in the Office of Religion and Global Affairs at the U.S. State Department. Previous government experience includes serving as a member of former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's policy planning staff between 2011 and 12, where he helped shape the U.S. response to the Arab Spring. At Mason, he was previously the founding director of the Center for Global Studies and also the director of the Ali Wural Aq Center for Global Islamic Studies. His previous visiting affiliations include American University Center for Strategic and International Studies and the Pew Research Center. He is the author of Transnational Muslim Politics, Reimagining the Ummah, and Politics from Afar, Transnational Diasporas and Networks. Thank you very much. We're gonna get started with Stephen. Stephen.
Great, thank you so much. It's a great pleasure to be with you all today. Many thanks to Kadir and Kelsey for the kind invitation. And let me just say, it's always fun and interesting to share the virtual dais with my friends and colleagues, Michelle Dunn and Peter Manville. My specific task here today is to talk about authoritarian systems in the region after the Arab uprisings and how the Arab uprisings shaped these authoritarian systems. Let me start out by making a few claims and observations first. One, no one should be surprised by the outcomes that we've observed in the region. That's because, two, social revolutions are rare, and what transpired in the Arab world a decade ago does not necessarily qualify as social revolutions. 2B, transitions to democracy fail more often than they succeed. And then my third observation is, and I think this is important and most germane to the remainder of my remarks, is that the defenders of regimes throughout the region have differing views on a wide range of issues. But if there is one thing that they agree on, it's that the events of 2011 were an aberration and should never be repeated again. This is, as I said, this is my launch point. But before I move forward, I just want to clarify a couple of things in case I'm not clear in the rest of my remarks. First, I've never argued that people in the Middle East do not want democracy or that democracy in the region is impossible. I am saying that for a variety of reasons, the uprisings in 2011 failed, but that doesn't mean that failure is inevitable should there be another round of popular uprisings in the region. But the question that we have to ask ourselves, besides why did these uprisings fail, what were the effects? And that's my job here today. What were the effects on the authoritarian system? The uprisings taught regime defenders, whoever they are, colonels, princes, generals, prime ministers, whomever, that prevailing political orders and whatever tactics that they had used to ensure those prevailing political orders actually did not work. The stability that they had sought, that they had believed that they had succeeded in bringing, was no stability at all. But rather than seeking demands or to accommodate demands for bread, freedom, and social justice, these defenders of the regime sought to re-engineer political institutions of the state to ensure that popular protests cannot threaten the status quo again. The result are systems that are fiercer, for lack of a better term, less tolerant of dissent, and importantly, well-equipped to prevent the quote-unquote aberration of 2011 from repeating itself. There is a combination of tactics that these regimes have used. There's old ways of doing things, mass arrests, the use of informants, pressure on the press. These were effective, but in many ways they were reactive. I think anybody who did dissertation research in the Middle East understood that their interlocutors were informing on them. But this was light surveillance of society, and that regimes and their defenders acted in generally reactive kind of ways. Since the Arab uprisings, there's a real sense that regime supporters, regime defenders have gone on the offensive and availed themselves to a variety of resources that help make it possible for them to more thoroughly repress dissent. First is, I think, quite obvious, and I think something that, you know, has been reported in the press rather often, is technology. surveillance has been used in ways in the Middle East in ways that they haven't been used before. They have availed themselves of new technologies that have made it possible to monitor larger portions of society. They're far more adept at this than they were just 10 years ago. And they've also become far more adept at misinformation across the region. It is startling to me to think about how far internal security services have come in the use of social media between 2010, 2011, 2012, and where they are now in terms of pushing out misinformation that either creates an environment of that creates support for the regime, or the idea that there is tremendous support for regimes, or they have unleashed this misinformation to undermine their opponents or would-be opponents. Second important way in which authoritarian regimes have been reshaped and continue to reshape and to be more thoroughgoing in their repression and dissent is international support for it. The outgoing administration quite obviously was not interested in issues related to political reform and change. In fact, quite the opposite. President Trump referred to Abdel Fattah Sisi as his favorite dictator, suggested ways in which Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman could cover up the Jamal Khashoggi murder more effectively, and remained silent on the kinds of repression, waves of repression that Turks have been experiencing. Europe, which people in the Middle East had also often looked at as an alternative to the United States to be better on the issues of human rights and freedom, has also determined that an era of political change is not only just over, but not likely, and have closed ranks with regional dictators for both reasons having to do with the wave of refugees going back to in 2015, as well as geostrategic interests. Third resource available to regional authoritarians and the way in which they've and that has been helpful to them in reshaping authoritarian systems is actually domestic political support. We don't know. This is something that's very hard to get at. We don't know the extent of support for leaders in the region. Polls quite obviously can't be trusted. They can't even be trusted here in the United States. It's hard to imagine how trustworthy they are when people in the region are being polled. But it's reasonable to believe that while the kinds of support that leaders want people to believe they have is not quite as large, it's still reasonable to believe that there are reservoirs of public support for these leaders in the region. I'm struck by the fact that leaders can go about doing the kinds of things that they are doing, and that millions of people in the region are either willing to go along with it or have just been depoliticized to the point where they accept what is happening. That is a form of support, and it is a way in which, and it is something which leaders in the region have taken advantage of in order to reshape, and as I said, reshape their authoritarian systems in ways that make them fiercer. And then I think the fourth resource available to regional authoritarians is something that I've touched on. It's the media creating narratives that are different from objective reality. This is not a phenomenon that's obviously given events in the United States, not just in the past week, but in recent years. This is a phenomenon that is not limited to the Middle East, but it is something that media in these countries have been harnessed to the advantage of these regional leaders that have advanced the repressive apparatus of the state. Now, I think the cases here are quite obvious. I won't go into too much detail into them, but just to highlight, I think the three most important ones And we can discuss them further in Q&A. First one, I think the paradigmatic case is, of course, Egypt. The coup d'etat that brought Sisi to power didn't necessarily change the regime. The political institutions and the interlocking social order remain. But in the words of my friend and colleague, Steve Heidemann, the officers upgraded Egypt's authoritarian system, and it has become a system that has at least been more efficient in penetrating society and sweeping up people who are threats, or more ominously perceived as threats. The Egyptian system was once one, as I alluded to before, was more reactive. Hosni Mubarak, I think, saw Egypt as a place to be managed, not a place to be resolved. And I think that that is a quite different outlook from the current crop of leaders who want to use a variety of methods in order to ensure the security of the regime. And those resources that I outlined before, I think, are extraordinarily important to them in advancing their own narrative about Egypt's future and how to get there. The second case is Saudi Arabia. Much of the changes in Saudi Arabia have coincided with the rise of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and his desire to rule the country more like his grandfather than his uncles. But it, undoubtedly, the Arab uprisings contributed to the transformation of Saudi Arabia into a police and surveillance state that reflects the kinds of police and surveillance states that we see in other parts of the region. Saudi Arabia has always been an absolute monarchy, but with many constituencies that required negotiation and consensus building and a significant amount of balance. That's no longer the case. Saudi Arabia obviously retains unique features, but as I said, its political system looks more and more like a typical authoritarian system, whether you find it in the region or in other places. And Mohammed bin Salman and his advisors have been shrewd in using technology, international support, building a reservoir of domestic support, and creating narratives that advance not just his parochial political interests, but advance the deepening of this surveillance police state, a trajectory change for Saudi Arabia. And the third case, I can't talk about these issues without looking at Turkey, a non-Arab case. The question that Kadir has posed to me is what changes on systems have the Arab uprisings had? And I think that that's not to criticize Kadir, but I think we need to look at what Turkey's own uprising has done to Turkey's political system. And that, of course, is the Gezi Park protests, which were not just confined to Gezi Park, a small park adjacent to Taksim Square in central Istanbul, but they were actually nationwide. By the time that they happened in 2013, Turkey had already begun sliding back into authoritarianism. But those protests produced a kind of new old authoritarianism based on a charismatic leader and a ruling party. It's hard not to look at Turkey and either draw parallels to the early period of the Republic or kind of Weberian Sultanism. It may, in this way, it's kind of historically rooted. But again, Turkish leaders have used all of the tools I articulated in order to innovate Turkey's authoritarian system. Now, finally, and I'll wrap up very quickly here, is the big question, and I think the big question that people ask themselves everywhere who look at these issues, kind of a tick in Washington, are these systems more stable, more secure than those that came before them? Well, I guess an argument can be made that they are, because of the way in which they have been able to penetrate societies, create narratives that are in contrast to objective reality, but that nevertheless millions and millions of people believe in. But I would say that they're not necessarily more stable or more secure. Because I think the balance of heroic vision, the ability to bribe constituencies, and coercion, three things that are, I think, critical to the success and durability of leaders, is off kilter. When you rely on coercion almost exclusively, it is expensive and it's dangerous for leaders. Still, I wouldn't go so far as to predict that these countries are unstable or stable. I think we have to look at them along a continuum of instability. Thanks, I'll stop here.
Sure.
Hello, everyone. Please forgive me for being a bit late. I don't know if Kadir mentioned I'm in the midst of a handling a pandemic-related crisis, but I'm really happy to be with you here today and talking about something else. I believe Kadir wanted me to speak about how the Arab Spring had affected U.S. policies in the Middle East and where do we expect the Biden administration to go. Now, we know that the Biden administration is going to approach this region in a pretty different way from the Trump administration. But to me, the question a little bit is how much will the Biden administration replicate the Obama administration approach to this region and to the issues surrounding the Arab Spring, and how much will it be different? So I was just thinking about this in terms of what's similar. What's similar, I think, about the Biden approach to the Obama approach and the situation in the region now compared to when Obama was in office, and what's different. So I'll tell you, here's what I think is similar. So I think many of the people who will go into the Biden administration, who we see going in already, have a kind of similar thinking to people from the Obama administration. I think they have a desire to show principled American leadership in foreign policy, as opposed to what I would say is sort of more the individual deal-making approach of the Trump administration. I think there will be more of a kind of normal national security decision-making process that balances various U.S. interests and so forth, as opposed to the Trump approach, which was quite unpredictable and which also was, you know, willing to sacrifice a lot of interests that you know, historically the United States had valued, or considerations and things that the United States had taken into consideration. And I also think the Biden administration, like the Obama administration, will have a predisposition to work multilaterally, including in the Middle East, to work with allies, to work with international organizations within the UN system, et cetera, all of which, of course, we know President Trump hasn't done. I also think in another way, there's the Biden administration will come in with, in some ways, a similar approach, actually, of the last several administrations, not only Trump, but also Obama, and even at the beginning, the George W. Bush administration, which is wanting to reduce the U.S. investment in the Middle East region while protecting key American interests. And I think the Biden administration is going to face a really important question, which is how to do this and how to diminish the American military presence in the Middle East without sacrificing key interests. And one of the big questions that will be on the table is, does that mean we arm our allies to the teeth? Does that mean we pour a lot of arms into the region? We see this very large arms sale to the UAE being pushed forward by the Trump administration, for example. And I also think the Biden administration, like the Obama administration, is going to come in wanting to, you know, reach some sort of an agreement with Iran on its nuclear program in particular, and knowing that the new administration is probably going to have some tension with its allies in the region, with Israel, with Saudi Arabia, with Turkey, you know, related to Iran, as well as other issues. Now, what's also similar, you know, oddly, is that President Biden is coming into office in the midst of a major domestic American and international crisis.
You're right.
And of course, I would say what's going on now between the pandemic and then the American political crisis related to the insurrection last week and so forth is it's even worse, I think, than the financial crisis that that Obama faced, although that seemed pretty big at the time when Obama came into office, right? And these major crises, you know, really make it difficult for the United States to focus on foreign policy and, you know, restoring American leadership, which is how I think the Biden people see themselves in a way, and the Obama people saw themselves that way too. There's another similarity I want to mention in terms of the situation in the Middle East now compared to when Obama came in 2009, which is that I think Biden's going to face a lot of turmoil in this region. You just heard Stephen Cook talking about the fact that although some of the authoritarian regimes in the Middle East are very coercive, they may not be very stable. I think that the pandemic pressed the pause button on protest in many places around the world, including for the most part in the Middle East, but that this whole enormous wave of change of the Arab Spring is by no means over. And that I think there will be a renewal of protest, of turmoil. Very difficult to predict in exactly which countries, but I think it will happen during the 4 years of the Biden term. And I don't think the Biden administration people expect this any more than the Obama administration people did. The Obama administration came in not expecting the Arab Spring at all, right? And then being surprised by it. I could see that happening again with Biden, right? So now let me talk about a little bit what I think is different between the situation now and the Biden administration as opposed to Obama. Now, whenever there's a change of party in the White House, as we know, there's a tendency for the new administration to want to do exactly the opposite. You know, everything that the predecessor did was wrong. And that will be the case now, even more so maybe than in past turnovers of the White House. However, the way I think, if we look at the specific issues related to the Arab Spring, if we look at issues of democracy and human rights and so forth, the way the Biden administration are coming in and positioning themselves is very different from the Obama administration. If you recall, the Obama administration came in a way thinking George W. Bush had pushed too hard on those issues. And yes, although Obama made a nice speech in 2009, those issues were a little bit on the back burner. Now, I think the Biden administration comes in thinking, no, we have to, those issues do have to be out in front. And they've talked about it a lot. They believe, you know, President Trump completely abandoned those issues, at least in the Middle East. And so they, you know, they see themselves as bringing values back, you know, ending what one of my colleagues at Carnegie calls the values holiday, you know, ending that and bringing values back into foreign policy. And, you know, people are talking a lot about how what we're going through in the United States right now really tarnishing the reputation of the United States, the ability of the United States to speak about democracy internationally. I'm not sure that's how people in the Biden administration will see it. And in fact, I think they will you know, want to have those values as part of the policies, not all of it, but part of the policies in the Middle East, even more so because of the challenges to democracy that we are handling inside the United States. The last thing I want to say is there is something about the situation in the Middle East that I think is very different now compared to 2009, or even indeed compared to 2016 when President Trump took office, which is that there's a big change going on, which is the looming end of the oil and gas era in the Middle East. And oil and gas wealth, of course, it's not over, but we can see the sunset now. We can see that, you know, of course, there's a glut of global supply of oil and gas, and therefore what the authoritarian regimes in the Middle East rely on is of an asset of declining value. And of course, we can see that global demand for these resources is going to peak and start to decline. Already, you can see signs of this. I don't want to go into details, but I see many signs that the regimes in the region, particularly in the Gulf, see that their wealth and their importance in the world has already started to decline and will continue to decline. And they're reacting to that in many ways. And so there's a very, very big change underway in the whole political economy of this region that, and I don't think that was the case. So, you know, back when Obama came in and so forth, their oil prices were high, and there was, you know, there was a sense that some of the governments had a great deal of wealth to buy social peace internally and to spread around to control. I mean, you know, Stephen just mentioned the 2013 coup in Egypt, you know, for which the Gulf governments gave Sisi $20 billion. So, but I'm not sure that type of thing is going to be possible again. We're going to see a real reshuffling of, you know, of power and regional alliances. It's not going to happen overnight, but I think it's going to be unfolding. It's going to start unfolding during this Biden administration. So I'll stop there. Thanks very much.
Peter?
Great. Thank you very much, Kadir, and greetings, everyone. I'm grateful to you and Kelsey for the invitation to be part of this discussion. It's always, as Stephen said, it's always wonderful to share a panel with my good friends and colleagues, Michelle and Stephen. So in my remarks, which I'll keep fairly brief to maximize the amount of time we have for discussion together, in my remarks, I want to talk a little bit about the question of Islamism as a political force in the Middle East, and how we should think about that in relation to questions about shifting modalities of authoritarianism, new regional dynamics, and the question of how the incoming Biden administration might approach its own policy of engagement towards Islamist movements. And I'll just clarify at the outset that when referring to Islamists, I'm primarily referring to the phenomenon that we might call electoral Islamism or mainstream Islamism. I'm not talking about, for example, primarily Salafi jihadi groups such as ISIS or Al-Qaeda, but rather groups such as the Muslim Brotherhood, Ennahda in Tunisia, those Islamists who have chosen to participate within the formal political system, and more specifically to offer themselves as a choice among others to electorates in the region. Now, I think that the conventional narrative around Islamism in the during and in the immediate aftermath of the Arab uprisings was the idea that we saw a kind of phenomenal ascent in their political fortunes, followed fairly shortly thereafter by an equally dramatic crash, that we've seen this sort of upswing and downswing. Obviously, Islamists were some of the earliest beneficiaries of regime changes and transitions in the region, appearing to be the segment of the political spectrum in the region that was best able to take advantage of changing political opportunity structures afforded by, for example, the revolutions in Egypt and Tunisia. Although we should also remember that in Libya, for example, up to 2013, the reemergence of the Libyan Muslim Brotherhood and its role as a fairly dominant political force in that country for the first couple of years following the ouster of Muammar al-Gaddafi. So there's this idea that, you know, Islamism rose and then fell dramatically and is now essentially a spent force, either, you know, being removed through elections or a loss in popular support, as appeared to happen in Tunisia in 2013 and 2014, or, of course, as we know all too well, in Egypt through a military coup in the summer of 2013. I want to suggest, however, that that narrative of a rapid rise and equally rapid fall of Islamism is a little too simplistic, and that, in fact, the present status and standing of Islamist groups around the region is far more complex than that. There are a number of countries where Islamists continue to function as important and, in some cases, significant political forces. I think, for example, of Morocco, where the Party of Justice and Democracy is still the party of government in that country. In Jordan, that country's last round of elections returned a faction of the Muslim Brotherhood as the single largest opposition bloc in its National Assembly. In recent elections in Kuwait, for example, the Islamists actually increased their share of seats in that country's assembly. And of course, you know, we still have in Turkey an example of a government that has very strong Islamist Chinese inclinations and has been playing a very important role with respect to the regional dynamics around Islamism, more of which in a moment. So I think it's important to kind of start by recognizing that this narrative of a rapid rise and rapid decline of Islamists isn't quite accurate if we look at their current status and standing across the region. Now, Stephen, in his remarks, referred to our collective good friend Steve Heidemann's idea of an upgrading of authoritarianism. I like to think of it in terms of a metaphor from computing and technology, and the idea that the kind of operating system of authoritarianism in the Middle East has been both patched and upgraded, in the sense that the Arab uprisings revealed certain kinds of vulnerabilities that were then kind of patched in the same way that an operating system update might happen with your computer, as well as some new features and enhancements being added. I think one of the chief vulnerabilities identified by a number of regimes across the region was the idea that popular support for Islamist groups of the Muslim Brotherhood variety was indeed an existential threat to incumbent regimes. And so part of the enhancing and patching involved the introduction of fairly draconian new policies that sought to securitize, criminalize, and essentially negate political Islam as an effective social and political force across the region. I think the draconian crackdown on the Muslim Brotherhood that we've seen in the aftermath of the 2013 coup in Egypt is the chief exemplar of this. We've reached a point now where arguably the Muslim Brotherhood is more oppressed than it's ever been, even under Hosni Mubarak in the late 1960s. And of course, that position that the Sisi government in Egypt has taken has been enthusiastically supported and in some way shaped by the patronage and influence of the United Arab Emirates and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, both of which have also realized the risks to their own monarchies, potentially, of growing popular support within their countries for Muslim Brotherhood style Islamism. And this is where I think where we link now to the kind of regional dynamics around Islamism and the idea and the need to recognize that at present, the question of support for or opposition to Islamism has become one of the defining aspects of a new geopolitical axis in the region, one that pits countries like Qatar and Turkey in their support for Islamism on the one side against countries like Egypt, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and a couple of others such as Sudan that they've managed to pull along with them through a variety of incentives who are opposed to and make opposition to Islamism a defining feature of their broader conduct in the region. Now, looking ahead, however, my sense is that the situation is going to continue to be kind of complicated and fraught for a variety of regions, not least of all because the examples that I cited at the beginning of my remarks about the relatively advantaged position that Islamists enjoy in certain countries is coupled with the fact that we know that in other countries, there are still fairly significant repositories or pockets of support for Islamists, including even in Egypt. And indeed, an early review of new data coming in from a project that Kadir and I, in fact, are working on together suggests that among the Egyptian population, we still find significant levels of support for Islamist social and political forces, even in the context of this intense securitization and crackdown on all forms of political Islam. Now, this is still a complicated future that Islamist groups face, not least of all because of the enhanced authoritarianism and security patches to the vulnerabilities that opened space for them to become more prominent. But I think also it's important to recognize that there are changes afoot with respect to what we might call the broader political sociology of Islamism in the Middle East. And this is the fact that while we might see people gravitating towards and expressing support in the abstract for a political project or ideology called Islamism, it's not entirely clear to me, and recent social science research would suggest to those who express support for such groups, what that actually means or what exactly it is they support. It used to be that in the 1980s and the 1990s, the groups that described themselves, that labeled themselves as Islamists, that understood themselves to be the chief exponents of the kind of modern Islamist movement, had a fairly clear agenda and a set of political positions that they organized around. Today, I think it's increasingly vague and diffuse. It's increasingly difficult to identify what an Islamist political agenda actually looks like. When you talk to, certainly in my own recent conversations with young political activists in the region, including some who continue to identify, in a sense, as Islamists, my impression is that they are gravitating towards Islamism not because it describes and names a clearly delineated alternative political agenda, but rather insofar as it functions as a symbol of something other than the prevailing authoritarian status quo. Amongst these young political activists, my sense is that people tend to trade less in expressions of affiliation and support for kind of conventional points on the political spectrum that we know of as liberalism or Islamism or secularism or leftism or solidarity with workers and labor movements, and to express their politics more dichotomously in terms of support for or opposition to regimes. And that's sort of the defining axis of political engagement in the region. So going forward, I think that one of the challenges that Islamists will face, despite some evidence that there is at least a nominal level evidence that they enjoy ongoing popular support, is the idea that their identity, their agenda, the very definition of what constitutes Islamism is, to my mind, increasingly vague. So that, you know, in addition to these structural constraints on their political engagement, I think it's fair to say that Islamism today is something of a crossroads in a more existential sense in terms of questions about what it actually means today to be an Islamist. One quick thing that I would flag in terms of places that we tend to not pay attention to with respect to the questions of mainstream political Islam, but where these groups may emerge as significant, are actually those countries that are hopefully in the process of emerging out of several years of civil war and conflict, namely Yemen, Syria, and Libya. Three countries which, of course, have in them branches of the Muslim Brotherhood that have been fairly significant politically, and which I sense may be positioned to emerge as important political brokers in the context of any peace settlements that resolve those conflicts. Finally, just a word on U.S. engagement with Islamist groups, which is something that I was involved in myself during my time at the Obama administration. My guess is that the Biden administration will be kind of first and foremost pragmatic in its orientation on this question. The Clinton State Department that I worked in was essentially forced to come to terms with and figure out how to do business with Islamists, because in countries like Egypt and Tunisia, they became the governments. And so it was important to be able to do business with them. I don't think that a Biden administration is likely to rush to refresh and reinvigorate a policy of engagement with Islamist parties. But as Michelle pointed out, if greater support for democracy and human rights is something that an incoming Obama administration is going to take seriously, then it is going to need to be able to engage, for example, with the Sisi government about the treatment that supporters and members of the Muslim Brotherhood have received in recent years. And I will leave things at that. Thanks very much.
What you just heard was part two of a two-part series titled The Arab Uprisings Revisited, sponsored by the Baker Institute Center for the Middle East, and was held earlier this year. For more information or to watch both parts, including the question and answer sessions that followed each discussion, visit the Baker Institute for Public Policy's website, and that is www.bakerinstitute.org. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM and streaming on the web, kboo.fm. I'm Don Jacobson, and moving on, we'll be here in just a few minutes right after the news.